we are at an inflection point, a transition from more than 200 years of the global industrial and technological infrastructure being fed by fossil fuels to a future where the global industrial and technological infrastructure will be built by and largely fed by specialty metals.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. In this Money Maze podcast curated edition, we're going to discuss the radical shift underway in the world of strategic metals essential for the energy transition, a shift that has been dubbed as creating once-in-a-century investment opportunities. As listeners to the Money Maze podcast know, I'm an old value investor not prone to investment hype, but have been following these developments for the last few years and am fascinated by my guest's observation that this process is reshaping whole industries, altering the geopolitical landscape, and the key to success will be the ability to secure the supply of the technology metals. And my job today is to help set out why this seismic shift and why TechMet, at the epicenter of this, and its founder and CEO, Brian Mennell, stand to benefit from this revolution. So the plan is to discuss this transforming landscape, the huge supply-demand imbalance, the geopolitical challenges and realities, and the potential returns from being invested, and how my guest business is organized. So without further ado, Brian Mennell from TechMet, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It's good to be here.
So I know you're widely quoted on the FT and Bloomberg and industry events on this topic, but just allow me to look back for a second. And doing some research ahead of our conversation today, I actually realized that it was your grandfather who had founded the Anglo-Val Group. So is it true you really grew up as part of a mining dynasty?
I did. My family's been involved in mining and industry in Southern Africa since the 1930s. So it was very much part of my upbringing and my life, and has been the focus of my entire working life and career has been mining and metals.
So just frame that journey before we get on to TechMet, because after university, did you head straight into the mining industry?
After graduating from university in the US, I joined De Beers in London, who was in partnership in the Venetia mines and Finch mines in South Africa with the Anglo-Val Group, which my family still controlled at that time. And I worked for De Beers in London and Antwerp and Namibia in the diamond industry for close to 8 years.
We had a terrific episode with De Beers a few months back that was very revealing for me, not knowing much about the whole diamond industry. So let's just set the stage here, because I think it would be very helpful for investors to understand this global revolution that's underway. And you've been quoted as saying that the West is losing a war they didn't know they should be fighting. So can you summarize the state of play?
As you said in your intro, Simon, we are at an inflection point, a transition from more than 200 years of the global industrial and technological infrastructure being fed by fossil fuels to a future where the global industrial and technological infrastructure will be built by and largely fed by specialty metals. And that is a massively transformative evolution. That affects not only critical mineral supply chains, which is our business, but many aspects of the global commercial and economic infrastructure. And this was something that the Chinese state saw 20 years ago. And over the last 20 years, they have had a free rein to build dominant or controlling positions across these global supply chains for critical minerals while everybody else was sleeping. So they have now secured between 65 and 95% control of global supply of all of these key critical minerals going into the EV ecosystem, renewable energy systems, and the energy transition more broadly. So they have indeed won a war that nobody knew they were fighting till they had lost it. And their dominant position has very concerning implications.
Just help me and help listeners and potential investors understand, why are these metals to which you refer so critical in this transition?
The transition to renewable energies and electric mobility are very minor metal intensive. The reason for this is that they're dependent on batteries, and batteries, in the case of lithium-ion batteries, require lithium and nickel and cobalt in quantities way beyond any historical production of these metals. Many multiples of the present global supply of these metals is required to meet the EV penetration targets and the growth commitments of all of the big global automakers. Renewable energy systems, in order to further dominate national grids with wind and solar, require battery storage because these are intermittent power sources that for grid stability require storage. And again, these are other chemistries of batteries in addition to lithium ion, but all that are very minor metal intensive. And then the electrification of bigger parts of the industrial infrastructure requires grid development, which is very copper and tin intensive. There's a whole range of these metals that are the key ingredients of all aspects of climate change mitigation and in the energy transition.
And why would something like tin, which we all sort of look back on as a prehistoric or an ancient metal, be so significant?
Tin is the connector and solder on all electronic circuit boards. So an electric vehicle requires almost 7 times the tin of a diesel or petrol engine vehicle. So tin is much less publicized and much recognized, less recognized as an energy transition metal, but it's absolutely crucial in all electrification.
So when we bring it from that high level down to an industry level, let's just talk about the global car manufacturers. Are they worried about what they need to do and how they're going to be capable of doing it?
They are worried. And the VWs of this world are putting an enormous amount of effort into understanding the supply chain, feeding their EV programs, and how to secure preferential access to these battery metals and rare earth metals to feed the capacity that they're now committed to building as they electrify their fleets. But I think their concern needs to turn to panic because they're still 5 years behind where they need to be with regard to their supply chains, and there's a very real risk of them waking up in 5 years' time and only being able to utilize half or two-thirds of the capacity they're building because they just simply cannot get the units of nickel and lithium and cobalt and rare earth metals to feed their capacity, even if they want to be beholden to China, because China increasingly are not going to be able to supply their own industrial demand. Because the scale-up of demand as the exponential of growth technologies continues to accelerate is undeliverable by our industry. The markets and our industry have failed the world. We needed to deploy $100 billion 3 years ago to avoid this cliff of structural undersupply that is now almost unavoidable in the next 3 or 4 years.
Just help us understand, why is it so difficult to identify and commercialize these deposits needed to produce these metals?
Mining is not only a capital-intensive business, but it's a very time-intensive business. On average, it takes, I think, 14 years to take a resource that has been identified through to development and production. And that contrasts with the 2 or 3 years it takes to build a new battery gigafactory. So there's a mismatch, which is going to result in ongoing structural short supply over the next 10, 15 years, as opposed to a 2 or 3 year market inefficiency that's remediable. So this is really a 20-year dislocation that, on the one hand, creates massive value creation opportunities for tech met, because these metal prices are going to have to go up much further and stay up much longer to incentivize growth and supply to balance out this exponential growth and demand, which is unstoppable. But it's a massive problem for the world because we needed to do this 5 years ago.
And I'm going to ask this uneducated question, which is really, is there no obvious substitution?
Battery chemistries and battery technologies are continuing to evolve. And to some extent, this evolution will be driven by availability and pricing of metals that go into manufacturing batteries. So the markets will help to bridge this gap, or technology and innovation will help to bridge this gap. However, because of the long lead times in the development, commercialization, and testing and safety certification of new battery chemistries and technologies that are going to sit under a family traveling at speed at high temperature. There's a 12 to 15 year window of roughly the present chemistry and configuration of lithium-ion batteries being the dominant power source for electric vehicles. There might be more LFP relative to NMC, and solid-state batteries might start to play a significant role, but they require all of the same metals. So it doesn't really mitigate this massive short supply issue for critical minerals.
Okay, so that brings us squarely to TechMet. You founded in 2017, and so as we talk about your company, what was the genesis? Where was that idea born?
It came out of a growing realization in 2017 on my part that all of these key metals, building, climate change mitigating technologies, demand for which had to accelerate as the energy transition progressed, were in structural short supply and were controlled by Chinese supply chains. And therefore, on the one hand, our industry needed to utterly transform itself and does need to utterly transform itself in terms of volumes. Our industry needs to transform itself in terms of playing a constructive and responsible role in two ways. One, in balancing China's dominant position from a geopolitical perspective and from the perspective of European and US national security and industrial competitiveness and jobs and economic growth and everything else that stems from that. And on the other hand, transform itself from an ESG standards, environmental impact, social impact, governance, transparency, and carbon footprint perspective in order to responsibly feed this clean, sustainable world that we want the energy transition to result in. So all of those factors resulted in me selling or spinning off everything else that I was previously doing in order to focus exclusively on TechMet from a point of view of personal investment, exposure, and obviously time, commitment, and effort for the remainder of my career. Because as I mentioned, this is a 20-year dislocation, not a 2 or 3 year market inefficiency, and a recognition of the fact that this mission was and remains to a large extent radically under-traded. It's remarkable given the obviousness of this market need, market opportunity, that there are not 50 TechMets yesterday, and the world needs 50 TechMets yesterday. And it's still much less competitive than it should be. The Chinese are everywhere and are very formidable competitors who've achieved a lot. There are a lot of junior and mid-tier listed companies that are in many instances badly funded and badly, particularly now badly funded in weak equity markets and badly run, who are in our metals and in our space. The big miners aren't generally in our metals. It's a very difficult area to invest in, which what we've created TechMet, we believe, is quite a unique platform of exposure to the key metals, the key technologies, the key low-risk geographies in this massive critical mineral supply chain challenge, so that our investors can get that balanced exposure in a way that is very difficult to do through any other investment opportunities.
So we're going to talk about a few of those. Let's just start at the company level. This is a permanent capital vehicle, correct?
Yes, we're a very simple structure. We're a private Irish company with one class of voting shares. We're building a multi-metal and multi-project industrial conglomerate as an investment company. So we have no management fees or carry, and we have no fixed time frame to our investment horizon.
Got it. So let's get into the weeds or under the crust, so to speak. How is the business constructed between its activities?
We at the present time have 10 operating companies, one of which is our partnership with Mercurio, which is one of our shareholders and one of the biggest global energy and commodity trading groups with whom we've created TechMet Mercurio, which we own 50%, they own 50%, which is a global trading, marketing, and supply chain management service platforms for all of our metals and metal chemicals. Our other assets are all private projects and private companies where we're the dominant equity funder, building either controlling or dominant minority positions, as we either fund expansion of production or late stage development through to production. And these are projects that either produce or process or refine or recycle our target metals, which are the key battery metals, rare earth metals, tin, vanadium, and a few others.
And of course, one of the problems about the mining world is often having to operate in inhospitable geographies. As I looked at your materials, I got a strong sense that, in fact, when we think about geographic diversification, you're operating in a lot of very developed countries. So can you maybe just give us a sense of that diversification, both of geographies and of the commodities?
No, we have chosen to invest in projects in low-risk jurisdictions and jurisdictions where we, as a team, have a long history of engagement. So we have networks of relationships, we have direct intelligence and ability to assess and manage risk. So we're heavily weighted towards the US, where 4 of our 10 operating companies are, and where almost half of our value is. Our other big projects are our nickel cobalt business in Brazil through Brazilian Nickel, where we're building a $1.2 billion expansion of our existing production to produce nickel and cobalt chemicals for battery manufacturing, very low cost, very low environmental impact, very low carbon footprint. Our African exposure is limited. It's less than 10% of our value and restricted to our tin and tungsten mines in Rwanda, which we are expanding significantly over the next 18 months, and a big rare earth metal from waste dumps from the old phosphate mines in South Africa, which we're preparing to invest in and develop on a large scale. In the States, we have a lot. We're doing lithium in California. We're doing battery recycling in Texas and Ohio. We're doing cathode manufacturing in Ohio. We own US Vanadium, which is the biggest vanadium specialty chemicals producer, with 2 plants in Arkansas processing industrial wastes. In Europe, we're building a rare earth separation plant, or part of building a rare earth separation plant in Norway with Norwegian government and Swedish government. And Cornish Lithium, we've been the primary funders of, now together with UK Infrastructure Bank as a UK government equity provider and the Texan private equity group, to build lithium chemicals production, both from hard rock and brine-based resources in Cornwall. We're only North America, South America, Africa, and Europe, with a fairly heavy weighting towards the US.
So let's just shine the spotlight on one of those, because I looked at the video related to it and tried to sort of understand how it came about. And that's your investment in Brazilian Nickel. Can you just, as a test case illustration, just give us a sense of the origination and the execution?
Yeah, this Brazilian Nickel was founded by a team that we've known for many years, who over the last, I think now 12 years, have pioneered a unique heap leach process to extract nickel and cobalt chemicals from this particular type of nickel laterite resource in a manner that's low cost, low carbon footprint, low environmental impact, and produces a product suitable for the lithium-ion battery manufacturing supply chain. We've been their primary funder from early on in TechMet's history. I think from mid-2018, we've been funding their further development and feasibility work. More recently, we've funded the development and commissioning of their first commercial plant, which for the last year has been producing and selling product into the battery supply chains in Europe, the US, and elsewhere. And we're now in the process. As we've funded, we've built a dominant and now controlling equity position. We now, as TechMed, own over 60% of Brazilian Nickel. We're still in partnership with founding management and with some other co-investors who've come along with us as we've developed, but we dominate and control the company. We are now in the late stage of securing a $1.2 billion funding package for the large-scale expansion of Brazilian Nickel, which we intend to participate in at the Brazilian Nickel equity level, but in partnership with providers of capital, both debt and equity at the project level. And we hope we'll conclude that funding package over the coming months and commence in Q1, Q2 with large-scale development to produce, to build what will be one of the top 7 or 8 nickel producers in the world and the lowest carbon footprint amongst them and one of the lowest costs amongst them. And this is the first of what we hope will be a number of Brazilian Nickel projects to replicate this billion-dollar project times 2 or 3 or 4 with other suitable resources that we've secured the rights to or are busy securing the rights to elsewhere in Brazil. And there are a number elsewhere in the world that we'd like to move on to create one of the biggest nickel producers in the world over the next 5-10 years, as the importance of nickel and cobalt continues to excavate for lithium-ion batteries.
And when you sit in front of capital allocators, how do you essentially condense the investment proposition and how should potential investors think about the timelines for returns?
We've created a lot of value over the last 5 years, but obviously it's just the beginning. We're very fortunate to be very well positioned with a very scalable portfolio of assets and team and strategy and network, and with US government who are equity holders of TechMed. All of the projects we invest in have the opportunity to crystallize and extract value over a 2 to 10 year time horizon, as we did last year with the listing and exit from Li-Cycle, which is now one of the two biggest lithium-ion battery recycling companies in North America. We exited from that investment. We realized a 6x value uplift for TechMed over 18 months, paid a substantial dividend last year and redeployed the balance of the proceeds in continuing to expand our other projects in our portfolio. And that's a model which we will continue to execute and deliver on as we build value, extract value, pay dividends, redeploy, build more value. So we don't preclude the possibility of a sale or a listing of TechMed at the TechMed level over the next 3, 4, 5 years. But in advance of that, we will continue to facilitate an active secondary market for our shares and continue to periodically crystallize and extract value at the operating company level and pay substantial dividends.
So let's talk about investors, both current and prospective. You mentioned the US government, highly unusual for them to have been invested in entities like this. I know Lansdowne in the UK, who we both know Pete Davis and team very well. They've been with you for some time. Up to this point, can you just give us a little color on how your investor base has looked and how you would like it to look over the next couple of years?
Yes, and we do need to evolve our investor base to continue to accelerate our growth, further scaling, expansion of our portfolio. As you mentioned, the US government are direct equity investors in TechMed. They put in a first equity investment in 2020. As the DFC, United States International Development Finance Corporation, as a U.S. government funding agency, and they have a further $80 million of funding authority that they want to execute in our present funding round, which we launched a week ago. So they're very important to us. They're very supportive. We were their first equity investment and remain, I believe, the only metals and mining company ever in history to have direct U.S. government equity investment. And it's good not only in terms of de-risking, in terms of credentializing and giving perceptions of the work that we did to get their investment, which is very de-risking for other shareholders, but it also gives us preferential access to other US government funding agencies, Department of Energy, Department of Defense, Exim Bank, all of whom we're busy with at the project level to further scale our projects with concessionary, cost-effective government funding sources, as we are with DFC, who are part of the debt funding of Brazil, as well as being equity funders through TechMed. Our other significant shareholders are Mercuria, which I mentioned as our partner in TechMed. Mercuria, our global trading and marketing platform, and are significant investors and are one of the biggest 3 or 4 global energy and commodity trading groups. A few institutions like Lansdowne, who have been very active investors and supporters of us over the last 3 rounds or 4 rounds of equity raising, and then family offices. I mean, from an inception, the family office universe was our primary focus, and we now have 85 family office shareholders who range from medium family offices across Europe and the US and elsewhere who have written checks of $2 million and $3 million and $5 million to a few big family offices such as S2G, which is part of the Walton family in the US, who are obviously much, much bigger and can and hopefully will continue to support us with much more substantial investments, and a few other big family offices in Europe and elsewhere. So from a point of view of how we would like to or need our shareholder register to evolve, to go to the next phase and the next level of scale of TechMed's development, we do need bigger checks from fewer parties. We do need to appeal to a more institutional audience, and we do need to focus on investors who can write $20, $50, $100 million checks rather than the very labor-intensive and time-consuming business of funding with $2, $3, $5 million checks, which is where we came from when we started raising money in 2018. And in that regard, we are now launching a further $300 million equity funding round and targeting bigger checks, obviously, beyond the further investment from many of our bigger existing shareholders who will follow their interest.
And just give us a sense of the size or the last valuation that's been carried out.
The last round we closed some months ago, we raised $200 million. The post-money value was $820 million. We now launched a further funding round targeting $300 million of additional equity, and the pre-money valuation of that is just short of $1 billion, which, as has been the case over the last five rounds of equity funding, we think is very modest and conservative, and therefore we're very confident that value level is one we can add very considerably to over the next 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 5 years, and beyond, as we have at the fairly conservative and modest value levels that we've raised money at over the last 5 years.
Let's talk about ESG. I think most of us would agree that there are some contradictions and challenges here. It's part of the investment process for investors to understand. And I suppose if I was being a little cynical, I would say that everybody wants the final outcome, but they don't necessarily want the dirty stuff that has to precede it. How do you think about the responsibilities attendant to the operations that you undertake and how you deal with that question?
Certainly, we adhere to very high ESG standards that we assist our operating companies, we're the dominant shareholder and dominant funder, to achieve, not only in terms of de-risking and compliance and traceability and transparency, but in terms of value add and high ESG standards, low carbon footprint, give one preferential access to sources of cheap funding and preferential access to market. So it's a value thing as well as a commitment to high standards driven elements of what we focus on as a priority across all of our assets. We do also are legally bound by the DFC to adhere to all of their ESG standards, which are very high standards as a government development funding agency. And they do oversee and audit our standards, and therefore we're much more ESG credentialized than our peers, all of whom aspire to similar standards and certainly use the same language in how they justify how they are developing and running their operations. It's a misperception that mining by its very nature has to be high environmental impact and lacking in constructive social and political engagement. Mining can be very constructive, both in terms of environmental impact, social interface, and can be responsible from a point of view of all aspects of governance and carbon footprint, and we have to be. It does take a little bit longer and it does cost a little bit more, and it is an issue with respect to competing with China, who imposes lower standards on their projects. But it's an essential element of the necessary transformation of our industry to responsibly feed the energy transition and climate change mitigation. And it is one that TechMet seeks to be at the forefront of in terms of standards and catalyzing industry transformation as a whole. It's also one that is increasingly required by our customers. The Teslas and GMs of this world are producing and selling a consumer product, part of the appeal of which is the fact that it's clean and it mitigates climate change. And therefore, they will increasingly be judged on the transparency and standards across their entire supply chains. And therefore, they need us to hold the standards that underpin the value of their brand and their products. And again, that's a very important driver, which gives us a competitive advantage because we do uphold high standards.
So let's talk about governance at your level, the board. I noted quite an interesting mix of folks on your board and your advisory board. Maybe you could just give us a flavor for how you've gone about populating your board.
Most of our board members, firstly, are a very experienced group with respect to independent experience and expertise from a governance, reporting, private equity, investing, risk management perspective. Most of them are round one or round two investors, so most of them are shareholders, but are fully independent and very active. And we do have board meetings every few weeks, and they do very actively engage in overseeing all of our processes and risk management across our strategies. So I think that we have a very strong and transparent governance structure. We have a very good shareholder agreement in terms of transparency and reporting and minority protections and rights. And we have a very strong advisory board from a global strategic and network value add perspective, chaired by Admiral Mike Mullen, who was former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and principal military advisor to both Bush Jr. and Obama, and has since been director of General Motors, director of Sprint, and many other positions, and has been enormously supportive and valuable, not only in Washington, but globally, many others. And obviously, you can see the group we've put together, which I think is fairly unique and scalable in terms of global strategic and network development.
I want to come back to competition, because I think if I'm summarizing it correctly, these are my words, but it's fractured when we talk about the West and there are no large players operating. The obvious question that strikes me is, if you are an Anglo or you're a BHP, is it that the size of these projects is not enough to move their needle? Or is it that they've been, I suppose, comfortable in their vast cash generation since 02, 03?
Yeah, there's no question that the big global mining companies are failing the world and failing their shareholders in aggressively engaging in these critical minerals that need to have their supply chains radically scaled and transformed. So the BHPs and Rios of this world have the project development expertise and capacity and the financial capacity to play a very important role, and they're generally not. They're generally not in our metals. The reason, as you mentioned, is that historically, the scale of projects and markets haven't been adequate to move the dial for them. It's very difficult to deploy $1 billion in rare earths or tin or vanadium or tungsten. You can increasingly in nickel and lithium, and obviously BHP is doing a bit more nickel, and Anglo wants to do a bit more nickel, and Rio is getting into lithium with their project in Argentina, having unfortunately had to withdraw from their big lithium project in Serbia. So there's movement and there's a growing recognition on the part of the big miners that they're missing out on the biggest mining boom of the last 100 years, and they need to get back into it. But by their nature, they're bureaucratic and slow and conservative and are likely to continue to do a lot less than they could or should. And that is a big problem for our industry, because we are short on capital. We are short on expertise and capacity to do what we need to do to scale production to meet this exponential growth and demand. The big oil companies are starting to look at our space, certainly with respect to lithium brines, which are a natural fit, and direct lithium extraction from both hot and cold brines, and that will again become significant over time. But they're also big, slow, conservative organizations who are unlikely to do as much as quickly as they should in terms of the contribution they could make.
We can't let this conversation go without touching on geopolitics. We have this war raging in Ukraine that will require an enormous rebuild. Question number one is, how will that impact your business in terms of opportunity rather more than supply? And secondly, given the geopolitical tensions, and I'm thinking here about China versus the US, how do you calibrate those risks, both in terms of supply and demand?
Yeah, I think the new Cold War, and it's unfortunate to use that terminology, but we are in a world of structural geopolitical competition between the US and China, which, and the periodic increases in tension and conflict associated with that competition, will be one of the defining factors of the world we live in for many years and decades to come. And that has a big bearing on this space. China has an overwhelmingly dominant position. They'll use that overwhelmingly dominant position with respect to all of these global critical mineral supply chains. They'll use it to advantage their domestic industry relative to those industries in Europe and the States, and they'll use it as a tool and a weapon in any escalation of conflict in this global geopolitical new Cold War. So it's a massive factor. Ukraine did focus attention on vulnerability of global supply chains. It did focus attention on Chinese access with Russia and other players on the authoritarian autocracy end of the world ideological spectrum, in competition with the world that we want to continue to dominate and triumph from a global commercial point of view. Peace in Ukraine will hopefully come sooner rather than later and spur a lot of infrastructural redevelopment, which will further drive demand for copper and other metals that are relevant to our space. And Ukraine itself has some very interesting strategic resources that could be developed and be part of the supply element of the equation from a Europe perspective. And normalization with Russia would obviously help in that regard. But it is a very complex and problematic global security and geopolitical landscape that we're investing into, which is part of the challenge and obviously part of the opportunity.
So I've got two closing questions. How would you both define success and give yourself a pat on the back 5 years hence?
We're very happy with our model and our strategy and fortunate position we're in at this moment in history. So we do want to do more of what we've been doing over the last 6 years in terms of bigger projects, bigger transactions, and scaling across all of our portfolio assets and strategies. So we, in 5 years' time, we want to not be the billion-dollar company raising $300 million that we are today. We obviously want to be a $5 billion company raising $1 billion to accelerate the scaling and make much more of a difference across all of these critical supply chains and in terms of governance and transparency and alignment with the right values and the right Western-aligned supply chains and energy transition initiatives and industrial competitiveness and growth. We're just at the beginning of a very ambitious and very big journey. We've certainly achieved a lot and we've had a fantastic run for the last 5 years and we've created a lot of shareholder value. But we do want to do it many times over the coming 2, 3, 5 years and beyond.
And who would you most like to meet to explain your investment case to?
We're doing a fairly good job, certainly in Washington, from a government interface point of view, to add value to their growing programs and priority of government engagement in critical mineral supply chain security. So I don't think we need help from a political point of view. We want to do more of that in Europe. We want to do more of that in Japan and Korea and elsewhere. Where we're very lacking as an industry is support of big institutional investors. So I would like to do a better job of educating the BlackRocks of this world to understand that if they're committed to net zero and they're committed to governance and they're committed to energy transition and climate change mitigation, all of which they claim to be, they need to get their head around the fact that the mining and metals industry or critical minerals requires hundreds of billions of dollars of investment. That's not all going to come from government. It has to come from private sector funding sources over the next 2, 5, and 10 years to deliver what they are all in the abstract committed to help to deliver. And they're not. There's still a sense that mining is somehow an ESG and PR liability that is best left to others, namely the Chinese. And that's not good enough, and that has to change. And governments have to help that change, and us as part of the industry has to help that change by convincing these large-scale sources of funding, private sector funding, pension fund funding, that this is not only necessary, but can be clean and responsible and well-governed.
Well, look, Brian, this has been a really insightful conversation. I'm going to take away 4 conclusions. Number one, the extraordinary shift that is taking place courtesy of the energy transition. Number two, the huge opportunities, but very high barriers to entry and execution. Number three, that ironically, as rates have risen and capital has become more scarce, so there is less money going at these opportunities. And if you are well-resourced and armed, the potential returns have become potentially even more attractive. And finally, that your vehicle has established a track record already and institutional allocators should really be looking at this space. Brian, thanks very much for being here today.
Great. Thank you very much, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.